Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
You're listening to HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill. I'm Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is Curtis Picard, President and CEO of the Retail Association of Maine. Welcome, Curtis.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. I think today we're going to be talking about a whole host of things, generally, in part because the Retail Association plays such a big role in the Maine economy and generally the New England economy. But I know that what's at top of mind for most people in all industries is recruitment and retention.
Absolutely. And I would say retail is actually a huge economic driver at the national level as well, especially going into this holiday season. You know, the focus is always on retail. And without question, like all other industries, we've been struggling to find enough qualified people to work in the industry. Last time I checked, there were about 3,400 available retail jobs open in the last 12 months, and it's been a real challenge to try to find people to fill them.
Those are just crazy numbers. And if you think about the importance of retail workers generally for how a store or how a company is viewed from the public, if you are standing in a store and you can't find something, and not only can you not find the item that you need, but you can't find a person who works there, it's just the epitome of frustration.
Right. And and you've certainly seen it throughout the retail, you know, industry. There are certain retailers that have done more either with technology or just kind of accommodating fewer staff. And it does ultimately impact the customer service experience. And that can be a real challenge. But other ones, you know, I think about Rennie's, because Rennie's recently spoke at our annual meeting. They're celebrating 70 years up here. And they freely admitted that their labor costs are probably twice of a lot of other folks, but they do that purposely because they don't want that customer service benefit that you currently know and love and expect at Rennie's to change.
And it's one of those aspects of being a long-term family-owned business, right, that really focuses on that. And then to recognize not only are the logistical aspects of having multiple stores throughout the state, but also making sure that the product gets there, but then once the product gets there, are your customers able to walk away with the product based off of having cashiers stocking of those items?
Right.
Just generally all the steps between it coming into a warehouse and then being on a store shelf.
Right, right. And nowadays, you also have to be more responsive to your customers and be available to them when they want to be serviced. You know, so you're seeing more with, not only next day shipping, but the ability to pick up your items in the store. And, you know, that started with the larger retailers, and now you're seeing it trickle down to the smaller ones as well. That's what customers expect, whether you're big or small.
And not just what customers expect. I mean, I'm thinking specifically of Hannaford's To Go. And this morning, actually, my daughter and I are talking about Hannaford's To Go. And she's talking about how she's used the service with her father before and how it's illegal to park in the Hannaford's To Go spot if you're not getting Hannaford's To Go. I'm like, well, there's no law. There's no laws.
I don't think it's technically illegal.
It's not illegal.
You're not going to get arrested or fined, but.
But it does screw up the way in which the service was attempted to be
absolutely
provided. But I think of her and the fact that at 8 years old, she's very fluently talking about Hannaford's To Go and expecting things from Amazon to come the next day. And this change in expectations of what that generation has just for a baseline starting understanding of retail environments generally.
Right. But, you know, it's always been like that in retail. There's always been the customer expectations that are out there that are constantly evolving and constantly changing. And that's one of the things I find most fascinating about working with retailers and working in this industry is that it's always changing and it's always going to be super competitive. You know, one of the examples I've used more recently when people talk about Amazon's impact and how big they are is I said, you also have to look back in history, and their example really isn't that unlike Sears.
Sears and Roebuck.
Yeah. Sears started out as a catalog first, you know, doing mail order. And then eventually they found they really needed to invest in brick and mortar. And what do you see Amazon doing now? You know, they bought up Whole Foods and they're talking about other retail formats and brick and mortar formats to meet those customer expectations. So to me, it's just kind of a fascinating look back that, you know, Sears was on top for a while and then came JCPenney and, you know, Walmart was cranking along for a while. And now Amazon is taking some of Walmart's market share. And even places like Dollar General are taking some of Walmart's share. It's retail is ever evolving and always super competitive.
And it's interesting, actually, to think about Sears and Roebuck, because if you think about the Sears and Roebuck model, I mean, you could buy anything from a home to a wedding dress and everything in between. You wanted to buy one nail or you wanted to buy a whole home. That was available in a Sears and Roebuck catalog. Amazon isn't selling homes. Amazon isn't, I mean, they are selling wedding dresses, so I'll take that off the table. But it is interesting to make that comparison generally.
Right. But if you look at some of the other things that Amazon is selling through their different platforms and actually working with smaller retailers or, you know, tech companies providing data storage and, you know, their reach is certainly significant and ever changing. You know, there's been talk for years that they're eventually going to get into the pharmaceutical business, pharmacy stuff, and that will create some disruption within, you know, chain and independent pharmacies potentially down the road. So, yeah, it is pretty fascinating. But I'm also old enough to remember when I was a kid getting that Sears catalog, flipping through it and circling things I wanted for Christmas.
Well, I think, you know, here's the thing. We jumped directly into retail discussions, but let's take a couple steps back. What does the Maine Retailers Association do? What role does it play in the market generally, and how does it interact maybe with other retail associations throughout the country or even just New England?
Yeah. So the association has actually been around since the mid-1930s. We were started as Maine Merchants Association, and we actually changed our name, I don't know, 8-9 years ago now to Retail Association of Maine to kind of update who we are and what we do. You know, back then we were referred to as MMA and people would confuse us with Maine Municipal Association or
Maine Maritime Academy
and even mixed martial arts, believe it or not.
Oh, that one wasn't at top of mind, but right. I'm sure for a lot of people it would be.
So we changed our name to focus really on retail. And also merchants was a little bit of an antiquated term. It doesn't have the same visual that you get when you think of retail. But, you know, our primary function is advocating for the industry at the State House in Augusta. So I spend a lot of my time doing those issues, and that ranges anywhere from sales taxes to plastic bags to trying to level the playing field between the Amazons and brick and mortar retailers. It can really be wide ranging. But more recently, we've spent quite a bit of time on workforce development. And we're very proud of a program that one of our national partners started, National Retail Federation, started a retail industry credential program called Rise Up. And the way it actually came about was there were a bunch of national retailers or significant size retailers, including L.L. Bean, that kind of got together and said, what can we do as an industry to start addressing workforce? We know it's an issue, but we know government's not going to solve it for us. We want a role in solving it for ourselves. And so they put together these three different credentials that they started rolling out nationwide. When we took a look at it, we went to them and said, look, we want to be the ones in Maine bringing it to the state. And where we've been a little bit different than what has happened in other states is that because Maine is so rural and so large and our population is spread out, is we really took a whole statewide approach to this. Whereas in other states, NRF and the state partner was focusing more on the large urban centers. So Chicago, Baltimore, or Dallas. And that's great. But, you know, and we have Portland, of course. But in Maine, you want to be able to make an impact statewide. And so we started bringing out these credentials to a lot of different partners. One of the first ones was the Jobs for Maine's Graduates Program. JMG does a really fantastic job of working with not all the high schools in the state, but a good number of them, and working with individuals that may or may not go to college, but, you know, perhaps may not be going to college, and preparing them to enter the workforce when they do graduate from high school. And, of course, retail is one of those avenues that's really great for people starting out in the workforce. And so the goal of the credentials is, number one, give them the skills they need to succeed. But number two, also show them that there's a real career path in retail, that it's not just part-time, no benefit jobs, that you can really do great for yourself in retail and through so many avenues.
Great. So I want to probably divide this up into a couple of different discussion points. And I think that it all does stream back to this idea of employment and making sure that we have jobs that are available first, and then jobs, people who can fill those jobs, right?
Right.
So one of the things that you mentioned earlier was kind of the work you do in the legislature at the state level regarding different issues generally. And for some people, and specifically, I think, in the retail environment, who followed the recent Wayfair case
right.
that the Supreme Court came down with. Can you – how about this? I'm going to give a really brief synopsis of what it was.
Sure.
And then I'd love to talk about the effect it had on the retail environment and kind of why that was important to the organization. So previously, for anyone who uses any online shopping methods fairly regularly, they may have noticed that they weren't being charged any type of sales tax by certain – online entities, right?
Right.
Which then made more sense. Well, if I can buy it online and not pay any sales tax, why would I go into a store? Why would I go to Rennie's and buy the same exact product and pay sales tax for it, correct?
Right.
So if I'm a penny pincher, like most good Mainers are, right, I'm just going to buy it online generally. So the Supreme Court came down and said what?
Supreme Court ruled that the legislation that was passed in South Dakota was constitutional, essentially. And what South Dakota did was, prior to this Wayfair decision, they used to say that a retailer needed to have some sort of physical presence in a state. And that was a real challenge for us and all the other states to get that leveling of the playing field. And so South Dakota was really had really good foresight in saying, look, you know, the economy has changed, and the previous Supreme Court decision didn't anticipate the e-commerce situation that currently exists. And so they came up with a definition of having with a business having an economic nexus in the state. And they knew it was probably going to be challenged in the court. So they actually wanted it to make its way to the Supreme Court, which ultimately happened. Maine was also smart enough to pass identical legislation to South Dakota. So that actually made it easier for us once the court ruled. We didn't have to do anything. It was already in place. And so it basically says if a company has some sort of certain threshold of economic nexus in a state, they have to collect and remit the sales tax. And the more states that did this, the easier and easier it was getting. You know, everybody knew that this is the direction it was going to go in and needed to go in. It, you know, what a lot of people don't realize is, even though you may have been shopping online for those years, not paying sales tax, you are still legally obligated to collect and remit that tax to state.
I know. I myself,
not everybody did it.
Had different piles of all of my online purchases
right.
I was then telling the IRS about.
Right.
No, but really, I mean, so then what we have is a situation in which there's a more equalized playing field
right.
between our local retail locations and the online markets, right?
Right. And you know, for a while, it for a consumer, it felt like they were getting that 5.5% discount, even though they technically weren't, but they were. And that can really be enough for someone to make that decision about buying in a store or buying online. And, you know, we can argue all day about sales tax policy and what should or shouldn't be taxed. But at the end of the day, if a state says an item should have sales tax to it, everybody should be collecting and remitting it.
And the goal, arguably, would be that if two things cost the same amount and you go into the store, arguably, you're likely going to purchase more things once you're in the store and see the other things that you need, want, or desire, which in all cases is going to be better for that retail location generally, which then hopefully is going to lead to the need for more jobs, correct?
Yeah, hopefully. But you know, an interesting side note on that, you know, you mentioned Hannaford To Go before. And so there was, I guess, some concern on the part of retailers, because especially as a supermarket, you know, how many times have you gone into Hannaford when you're hungry and you end up buying a lot of things you didn't intend to walk in with?
Absolutely.
And so the concern is, with Hannaford To Go, would consumers still be doing that? But I think what they found is because of the convenience they're providing to your customers, customers are still going into the stores to get what they need. They're doing it out of convenience sometimes, and they're meeting their customer needs in different ways.
I want to talk about that evolving needs. We're going to take a quick break, however. You're listening to HR Power Hour. I'm Connie Alvarez, and this is News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobsinme.com has been matching main employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobsinme to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
We're back, and you're listening to HR Power Hour. I'm Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is Curtis Picard from Retail Association of Maine. We're talking about all things retail today, but we're always bringing it back to that recruiting issue, the recruiting issue that not only retailers in Maine are experiencing, but pretty much all employers throughout the state experience.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, with the unemployment rate at, I think, definitely under 3%, I think it's 2.8 or 2.9%, whatever it is, you know, that's essentially full employment. And so retailers and everybody else are starting to have to look at perhaps some non-traditional workforce opportunities to try to find the people that they need.
Before the break, we were talking a little bit about the evolution in the industry generally. So we mentioned Hannaford To Go, and we're talking about other kind of on-demand retail experiences that are still going to be present within the state. And I say present with like a physical brick and mortar location.
Right.
Now, with the creation of or the evolution of this type of retail, does it change the needs associated with the jobs that retailers are looking for?
Absolutely. And that's been one of the things, you know, I've spent a lot of time talking about across the state is that, you know, I think most people, when you think of retail, you think of the front-facing customer service job, you know, the person that's checking you out either at the small boutique or the grocery store or whatever. And that it's just a part-time job with not many benefits and it doesn't pay well. But the reality is there's a lot of different career avenues that exist in retail. Certainly with the growth of e-commerce, and now you're seeing more and more small retailers make that investment in their e-commerce platform because that's where your customers want you to be. We've seen a huge rise in technology jobs and software engineers. There's always has been a real significant skill set in logistics and merchandising and buying and marketing and all those things that you don't necessarily see when you walk in the store, but certainly exist. And that's why we think there's some really good career avenues for folks in retail.
One of the things that I recently learned probably in the last 18 months was about the logistical aspects of a lot of this and the fact that there are jobs that are specifically set forth in order to save those seconds. So save 5 to 10 seconds. And the normal way in which they're doing that is saying, when you leave this entrance or when you're in this portion of the store and you need to stock shelves in this space, this is the route that you would take to get from point A to point B, and then this is how you will physically move your body in order to decrease the number of times you're bending, twisting, which has a big workers' comp element to it as well. Because when we're talking about stocking or movement of product, the chances or the likelihood of some type of injury based off of that repetitive motion is high. Yep. So when we think about not just the logistics of how we are moving our arm or our back or, you know, are we lifting properly, but also the route in which we're taking to get product from one side of the store to another, I think is so fascinating.
Yeah. There's a lot of fascinating technology like that. And I think I'm probably geeky enough to really get into it sometimes. But yeah, exactly what you said. And, you know, some of the other technology we've seen, especially some of the larger retailers, you know, we're getting into the winter season now. You know, we could have that ice storm or bad weather this winter. A lot of my major retailers have really sophisticated operations centers at their headquarters to really track major weather events and other types of things. And, you know, one of the things I'm most proud of is that when there is a natural disaster, retailers are some of the ones best equipped to help with that recovery. And they do a lot of work ahead of time, you know, so whether it's a hurricane or a nor'easter or some other weather event coming in, they have the ability to bring in equipment and supplies even before the storm hits, and then can help deploy resources after a storm hits to really help with that recovery. I've visited some of those operation centers, and they would just blow you away with the technology they have.
And it's been interesting also to see how retail locations are putting themselves into the community more. I mean, recently in Maine, there was a fairly large nor'easter, and there were some large retail locations that lost power. And to watch anyone who had perishable food figure out fairly quickly how to get rid of it to a resource that maybe had working freezers or that were homeless shelters or those type of things, I think has been really interesting to watch evolve, and something that I don't know if it was at the top of mind for other people or for this industry maybe 15 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, I can say our retail members have always been the first ones to help out when those situations happen. And, you know, maybe it's because I have a little bit of an insider's view, but what they actually do for their employees as well, you know, because your store may have power, but a lot of your employees maybe don't. And so what do you do as an employer to help your employees get through those tougher times? And they do quite a bit. And then even in the community where the local grocery store, I'm thinking of like Brackett's Market in Bath, had power, they made sure people could come in, charge up their phones, provide a few extra additional resources, you know, really be that pillar in the community.
And it's interesting to think about it as that as well, because it really becomes a hub generally for a community. The
right.
resources that you need for everyday survival and kind of general quality of life is going to come from a retail location.
Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit more. I mean, we've talked about the evolution of the jobs that are present in this industry. Let's talk about, for a lot of people, this is their first job. And I don't want to say first job out of high school, but first job in high school.
Right.
Let's talk about both the focus maybe that the association places on kind of keeping that streamline of employees coming in, and then how you either keep them in the industry or make sure it's accessible to people moving forward.
Yeah. So believe it or not, nationally, the statistic is, you know, 1 in 3 first jobs are in retail. And so it certainly was for me. It was an ice cream stand back in my hometown in Massachusetts where I grew up is where I kind of cut my teeth.
Not a real Mainer is what he just said.
I'm not
said,
a real
people.
Mainer. I know. I'm the one from away. It's my wife who's the native Mainer. And, you know, I still think about that that job. And I would say we keep a particular focus on that because I believe one of the challenges that we have as a society is that I think we have the smallest percentage of young people working in their teenage years. And I think that creates a lot of problems down the road. One, just, you know, these kids aren't getting that critical first job and skills. But two, it means they're not getting their first job till either after high school and college. And that puts them at a little bit of a disadvantage. You know, the ability to bring them in, teach them basic customer service and the importance of showing up on time and, you know, not checking your cell phone when you're waiting on a customer, and just the ability to make some mistakes along the way. That's what you do when you're a teenager. And, you know, there's a lot of great employers out there that want to hire as many high school kids as possible. This year we honored another ice cream stand, Fielder's Choice Ice Cream, with our Retailer of the Year. One of the things we looked at in evaluating them for this award was their ability to hire a lot of high school kids. So they have five locations. And during the summer, Mike and Sue Gilson employ about 180 high school kids, which is a significant number. And they do a great job with them. But it continues to be a challenge when you have a low margin business like homemade ice cream with increasing costs like increasing minimum wage and workers' comp costs to really continue to do that down the road. And they're going to be real challenged to be able to employ that many people given some of the other cost pressures that are happening.
I mean, it's interesting, these examples that you've given, because I don't think people realize or think about oftentimes the fact that retail is so broad that it also gets into food service.
Right.
It also gets into manufacturing. If you're a manufacturer who also has a retail location,
right.
Just generally kind of how broad the concept of retail is. Now, do you think that the seasonal nature of Maine itself and the influx of individuals that we have coming into the state for the summer months adversely affects kind of the, I don't want to say desire, but high schoolers being employed year-round in some of these retail capacities?
No, and I'll say this as a parent of a 15-year-old. You know, nowadays, kids have so much on their plates. You know, my son plays soccer in the fall, baseball in the spring. He does a lot of other extracurricular activities. But when he turns 16 next year, my wife and I definitely want him to get that critical first job. But we can understand the challenges with doing that, with just everything that goes on around school, around their sports and extracurricular activities. So it does make it a bit of a challenge. But like I said, to me, it's critical that he develop those skills in high school going forward. I mentioned my ice cream job first on, and one of the things I've always remembered, and I've talked about this before in different situations, is, you know, I was working at the ice cream store. My boss trusted me to open and close the store after a certain number of months. And there was probably some Saturday night, and we closed at 8 o'clock. And some people came in right at 8 o'clock, and I turned them away because I said, oh, you know, we close at 8 o'clock. Didn't think anything of it.
Very stringent to the rules.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, we closed at 8 o'clock. But the next day, being from a small town, that customer knew my boss, went in and said, by the way, you know, your staffer turned me away last night. And he called me in, and he probably could have yelled at me, probably could have fired me, but he didn't. And he just, you know, what he said has stuck with me ever since. He's like, you know, we exist because of our customers. And he's like, I don't care if you're here till 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock. If there's customers at the door, you keep serving them. And I've never forgotten that. So even what I do currently, we're a membership-based organization. We exist because of our members. And if I'm not meeting my members' needs, you know, we're not doing what we should be doing.
I mean, one of the, well, two ways, like maybe two-prong approach to meeting those needs. One, having a product that is high quality and that somebody has a need for, right? You have your supply and demand type economic look at it. And then also being around people who are good at either selling the product or the product sells itself and the person doesn't decrease the value of the experience of purchasing the item.
Right.
Now, we've talked some about kind of going to first job, that market. What other markets does the Retail Association look at, or the Rise Up program? What's it focusing on? Because we have such a low unemployment. So how do we bring people in to the market that either aren't being counted as unemployed, right? Or that maybe need a job and haven't traditionally been viewed as someone who's part of the labor market?
Yeah. So I'll take kind of two approaches here. I'll just quickly touch on Rise Up, because what Rise Up is really is three separate industry credentials that somebody can earn. So the basic one, the one we're primarily doing with Jobs for Maine's graduates, is called Retail Industry Fundamentals. And it's really for someone starting that first job. It gives them an overview of what the retail industry is, what to expect, the career paths that exist there. But beyond that, the next level credential that somebody can earn focuses on customer service and sales. And to us, that's something that spans industries. You know, you learn those basic customer service skills. Like I said, I still use them in the career I have now, and I'm sure you use them at the law firm as well.
Every day.
Every day. You know, where are young people going to learn those critical soft skills for them to succeed long term? So that's the second one. And then the third one is the business of retail operations and profit. And it gets really more into the weeds of really, of what retail is. And then the other aspect of this, when you look at retail and you look at these careers that happen, is that you hope that also down the road, there are going to be these people that maybe work in retail, whether large or small, doesn't matter, that someday say, you know what, I want to open up my own business. So there's this whole entrepreneurship angle there, too, that we don't often talk enough about. But that's Rise Up. But in terms of like other non-traditional workforce sources that are out there, we've been working with the Department of Ed Adult Ed Program, doing some different classes along the state with Rise Up. We've made some significant inroads with Goodwill, Department of Labor Voc Rehab Program. And believe it or not, there are significant programs out there for retailers to tap into to try to maybe tap into some of these workforce channels that they hadn't thought of before. So there's money there for training. There's money that can cover salary. There's money that can cover a workforce coach if that individual needs a little extra help getting acclimated to what they're doing. And so there's some really good programs out there.
I definitely want to circle back around on this, but it is time for us to take a really quick break. I'm Tawny Alvarez. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobsinme.com has been matching main employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsinME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsinME.com. That's JobsinME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Life's never perfect, but as realtors, we know living it in the perfect place can make a big difference.
Imagine
hiding from your screeching children in that spacious walk-in closet, watching the neighbor's dog poop on the freshly sodded grass you negotiated during closing, dropping your cell phone in the toilet of the spa-like five-piece bathroom again. So get the perfect place to house all of life's imperfections. Get Realtor. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
We're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, and our guest today is Curtis Picard from Retail Association of Maine. We're talking about all things retail, but we really are focusing in on hiring and retaining valuable workforce. We've talked a little bit about the changes in the type of jobs that are available in this industry. And right before the break, Curtis mentioned some potential other ways in which we can keep people engaged and actually increase their skill set while they are employed with us. Curtis, you mentioned a state program that's going to provide assistance financially. And this is when everyone's ears perk up. When they're like, financial assistance? You're talking about a tax break? Or tell me more about what we're talking about here.
Yeah, so there's a number of programs. So, you know, Goodwill of Northern New England, based here in Portland and Gorham, actually has a very significant footprint, not only in Maine, but also New Hampshire and Vermont. So what I've learned is like every Goodwill that exists across the country is a little bit different than every other Goodwill. And our Goodwill, believe it or not, is one of the models for the rest of the country. And so what they do with their workforce, they can help provide retailers and other employers with employees that maybe have had some challenges along the way. Maybe they're dealing with a certain level of disability or other issues, but they're quality people. And Goodwill will work with you to integrate that person into your workforce, figure out what you need, how you can make them work. But we were also talking about Voc Rehab. And recently at our annual meeting, the folks from, I think it's Musam Valley Mushrooms, you know, the mushroom, the great mushrooms you get in Hanaford, you know, they started working with Voc Rehab a few years ago and ended up getting a bunch of people to help, you know, with their farm operations. And the gentleman from the farm talked about, you know, they had this one task at the farm that was like kind of like they would draw a hat, a name from a hat every day because nobody really wanted to do this job. I think it was like folding the boxes, the larger cartons they needed to put the smaller containers of mushrooms in.
So very repetitive.
Very repetitive,
kind
of a thankful task.
Set.
Right. But they weren't ever able to get kind of over the ability to do that. And so they started working with Voc Rehab. And I think they had some initial reservations as to how this was going to work because one of the initial people that came in needed a job coach with him or her during those early weeks. And they weren't sure, you know, how is a job coach really going to work? What's it going to look like? Ended up working great. And not only did this person do the job well, they made the job better. They came up with improvements for the job. And then that person in turn was able to train some additional Voc Rehab people down the road. So it really ended up being a really positive experience for the employer. Like I said, there are dollars there to help an employer. So, and I'm not sure the exact details, but it covered the cost of the job coach. I believe it covered part of the cost of the salary early on until they got established. So it was really a positive program.
And it created efficiencies, it sounds like, in the organization itself.
Right. And the most valuable part is you took somebody who was having a challenge finding a job and gave them a job with some value. And develop their skills and make them part of the economy, which is a win-win for everybody.
And it's one of the things that we talk a lot about when we talk about retention. I mean, it's not worth it to bring in individuals if you're unable to retain them.
Right.
And by providing employees with autonomy and a sense of ownership with regards to the task and the skills, by saying and providing that this individual is able to find more efficient and effective ways to perform the task, gives them that sense of ownership and a higher likelihood that the employer is going to be able to retain that
right.
skilled employee at this point in time.
Absolutely.
Do other states have a similar, so they have the Goodwill program. Is the funding coming then through the Goodwill program, or are there other state funded kind of programs that provide similar resources?
Yeah, I believe a lot of this funding is federal that flows through the different state agencies. So Voc Rehab is under Department of Labor. There's also like the Workforce Investment Boards, which is all part of the Workforce and Opportunities Act, WIOA, whatever it's called, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunities Act, I think is what that acronym stands for. And so there is a lot of focus out there on these different skill opportunities. And I think we've just taken a more proactive approach to say, we have this Rise Up program. This is a credential of value, which is all kind of the buzzword right now. You know, there's that Maine Spark organization as well that formed last year, and they've set a goal by, I think, 2025 that 60% of Mainers should have some sort of credential of value in their work. And so we see this as being retail's opportunity to bring some measurable statistics, you know, measurable accomplishments to the program and not just another workforce development task force that gets together and talks about it. we're actually doing something with it.
Now, with the Rise Up program, is that something that an employee would do through their employer, or can they independently come and join these classes and take these certificate courses and then place it on their resume as part of their credentials?
They can do all of the above. That's the best part about it. So the three credentials, initially Retail Industry Fundamentals was the only one that was available either classroom or online. Now all three you can do online as well. So like I said, we're working with these different channels. So JMG is doing it primarily classroom-based in the high school, which is great. Department of Education is also doing classroom-based with the adult ed programs, and they're trying to pull together a group of people from an area. But an individual retailer or an individual who just wants to earn these credentials can go online and complete one of these credentials, not only in a very short time frame. Retail Industry Fundamentals will take somebody only about 5 hours online. Customer Service and Sales about 14 hours online, and the Business Operations one about 11 hours online. So it's not a huge time commitment, and they're also not very expensive. $99 for Retail Industry Fundamentals, $115 for Customer Service and Sales, and $135 for the Business Operations one.
So for about $300, $350, you've got three certifications.
Three credentials
that are showing up on a resume that's transferable to any organization. And like you said, even if you chose to leave the retail kind of environment, these are transferable skills to other jobs.
Right.
So one of the things that we've been talking about kind of generally is this idea of retention, right? You get someone in the door, how do you retain them? And maybe a past viewpoint from society that this was a starter job that doesn't have any growth potential.
Right.
I want to talk about the growth potential in this industry and the fact that it's not just a job, but can also be a career.
Right.
One of the things that a lot of people kind of think about is the only way to grow in a career is to become a manager, supervisor. So you start off at an entry-level position, and then you become a supervisor. It sounds like with programs such as this, certificate-type programs, there's paths in which you can gain credentials and skills and continue to add value to the organization without maybe taking a traditional supervisor or manager path.
Yeah, without question. And I actually look back at my own career as well. So beyond, you know, working at the ice cream shop when I was 16, my first real job after college was working for the New York City Marathon, believe it or not. And I learned everything I know now about event management from working for that organization and merchandise. I was their merchandise director.
That's a pretty big event.
It was.
Too.
It's a huge event. It's only bigger now. I was there in the 1990s to 2000. It was a fantastic experience that I'll never forget. But I learned so much. But you wouldn't, you know, in high school and college, nobody ever said, oh, you should work for a marathon someday. And I've used this in my professional career. You know, I've been working in association and chamber management now for almost 20 years. And this was never talked about in high school or college. But running a trade association has been a great career for me because I get to do so much. I do marketing. I do membership. I do public speaking. We do event management. I get to meet with a lot of business owners. I get to meet with a lot of politicians. It's been fantastic. And I wish back in high school, somebody said to me, it's like, you know, you should think about running an association. It's a great career. But I've used all of the skills I've learned along the way in what I currently do, even though it was probably a very non-traditional path. And that exists within retail as well. I remember we were down at Kittery Trading Post sometime in the last year, showing a group of kids the different career paths that exist. And Kittery Trading Post is a great example because it's still locally owned, but they have about 350 employees. Most of their employees have been there for 10 or more years. But one of the examples they use that really stuck out with me is that they had a young woman who started out as a cashier, but come to find out she had a particular ability with social media. And believe it or not, and you probably have the same impression I do, when you think about who works in loss prevention in retail, you think of, you know, retired police officers or people with law enforcement experience. This young woman had a particular skill with social media. And believe it or not, people who steal from retailers are not the sharpest tools in the drawer and often share what they do on social media.
I actually did not even think of this. So the fact that I didn't even think about it, I think shows how insightful kind of her behavior is.
Exactly. So she was able to actually dig up not only who some of these people are, but who they're associating with. Because one of the things that retailers can do really well now is package a particular case for a police department. So it's not just calling them up and saying, hey, we, you know, somebody stole from us, solve the crime. The loss prevention groups are really getting very sophisticated and saying, we know who these people are. Here's all their associates. Here's all the information we've compiled on them. And a lot of that has to do with social media. So this young woman who started as a cashier showed a particular affinity for this skill set and now is thriving in a loss prevention role. And she's probably, you know, 5'2" and, you know, not a huge individual like you think of with loss prevention, and is really having a great career.
We have to take a break, but I want to circle back to this. I'm Tawny Alvarez. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBRadio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts, stoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs and ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsandme.com. That's jobsandme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour. I'm Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is Curtis Picard, Retail Association of Maine, President and CEO. We've been talking about a whole host of things, and prior to the break, we were just talking about loss prevention through social media and the general breadth of skills that the retail industry is looking for. I think that it was quite interesting. For those of you who are just joining us and who haven't been listening to us before the break, I recommend you go to the podcast and listen to Curtis's last 5 minutes, because he's given us an example of skill sets that we wouldn't normally think of as being necessary in the retail industry generally.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many skills there that you don't necessarily think of. You know, we talked about technology skills early on with e-commerce that obviously makes sense. But, you know, we were talking about social media, using that in loss prevention, and you know, there's just a whole host of things that individuals need to make retail succeed.
So while we can creatively think about skill sets that can play a role in retail and making retail successful, we also know there's outside factors that are placing pressure on us. And one of those outside factors is state and local government.
Yep.
What aspects of state and local government, and I'm going to say federal government as well, are you finding or creating the most heartburn for the retail industry?
Yeah, and I would say it's not necessarily one specific thing, but it's more the accumulation of a lot of different impacts. And so, you know, this past year we saw Maine pass its version of a paid sick leave law that ended up being a compromise piece of legislation that we didn't oppose in the end. But now we're getting to the implementation stage of it. And so there's a lot of unanswered questions about that that we're trying to work through with the state. But you can also look at the city of Portland, who was talking about enacting their own version of that, which thankfully they didn't. You know, the state legislation preempted Portland from being able to do that. But if you're a retailer that has a location in Portland and something else, a small retailer, having to comply with two very different ordinances or laws can be a real challenge. We talked early on about minimum wage. You know, minimum wage will be going up to $12 an hour next year. That has some unintended impacts. One, it makes it harder to hire high school kids. Number two is a lot of people don't realize that the salary threshold for overtime in Maine is tied to the minimum wage. It's set at 3,000 times the minimum wage. So that salary threshold has been going up. Number one, I'll say it probably should go up. You know, the federal level is $24,000, and now with us being at $11 an hour, it's at $33,000. It'll go to $36,000 in January. But as Maine's minimum wage continues to rise above $12,000, that salary threshold is going to continue to tick up. And in Maine, you know, a salary of $40,000, $45,000, or $50,000 is pretty competitive here in the state still. And if you're now telling somebody who used to be hourly and now their salary is going to have to go back to an hourly status because of overtime, that's going to be a disincentive for folks.
And so, I think when we look at the United States generally, one of the interesting things is as a state, Southern Maine, these numbers may not seem truly to provide that much pressure for employers. Employers should be paying this amount is kind of the argument you hear. But you have to recognize that this is the state minimum wage, which means it doesn't matter if you're in Fort Kent, if you're
right
in Kittery, that's the amount. And that's the new mandatory threshold for exempt versus non-exempt employers, the paid sick leave, all of these things. This isn't just a Portland-centric or Bangor, where kind of there might be the economic ability to sustain something like that. But we're also talking about the mom-and-pop grocery store that employs two people.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the segments that we've heard most frequently from is the independent grocery stores in Maine's more rural locations. And, you know, their biggest competitor is going to be someone like a Dollar General, who's now carrying milk and bread. Mm-hmm. And so the harder you make it for your local IGA or Shop and Save to survive, you know, everybody knows grocery stores are a low margin business to begin with. Even if you're a Hannaford or Whole Foods, it's a low margin industry. That gets magnified when you're a single store operator. So, you know, with these increasing costs, those are the folks we're hearing from most often about those kinds of costs.
Curtis, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And I know I've learned a lot today, and I hope our listeners have as well.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day. You've been listening to HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Join us next week.
And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
I want to take FMLA leave. But first, I want to use up all my PTO. Can I do that? Hi, this is Ben Ford from Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. The Department of Labor recently held that employees taking FMLA qualified leave must take that FMLA leave as soon as they, well, leave. This means that even though they may want to use their PTO, they must do so concurrently under the law. This also means that you, the employer, must provide the FMLA documentation when they take their leave and not when their PTO runs out. Of course, you can always give them more than 12 weeks than the law requires. You just have to provide that documentation. If you have questions about the interplay between the FMLA and your own internal PTO policies, call Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.